Hello and welcome to the February edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor, and in a moment I'll be joined by my colleagues at our charity Garden Organic, Chris Collins and Dr. Anton Rosenfeld. It's been a bit of a chilly start to the year here at Ryton. January saw some hard frosts and snow, but that hasn't stopped us from getting outside and planning the garden for the year ahead. In this month's episode, we sit down with Eddie Bailey, geologist and founder of Rhizophilia, where we do a deep dive into soil health and how you can boost productivity in your garden by looking after your soil. Later on, we'll be opening up the postbag, and this month, we're answering your questions on organic topsoil, rats, and plants that grow well on damp ground. Now, during our discussion, we talk about the use of pesticides on sugar beet. And since we recorded that segment, there's been some good news. The government has announced that this year it will refuse to allow the emergency use of a banned pesticide on sugar beet. Sugar beet producers have, in the past few years, managed to get an emergency authorisation to spray neonicotinoids on their crops. But this year, that has not been allowed, which is really good news for pollinators. So, on that note, I'm off to join Chris in the potting shed. Hello, Chris, how are you?
I'm very good, Fiona. How are you?
Yeah, really well, thank you.
Did you have a good break?
I did have a good break, very much so. Lots of relaxation, lots of looking out in the garden, lots of pipe dreams about, you know, going to do it better and brighter this year, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's that time, isn't it? Yes. I struggle not to get excited as February goes on, you know, because I just think that all that potential hasn't started yet, but you start to get that sort of, that chomping at the bit, I like to call it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's that kind of nice feeling in January. I bought myself last year, treated myself to an absolutely beautiful calendar this year, which is all about seed sowing. And it's really good because it says, don't worry in January. You don't have to worry. But then it starts to kind of give you ideas for February and you get all excited. I really do. I really enjoyed that kind of feeling in January. You don't have to feel guilty and you can just look ahead. So, looking ahead now, the one real blessing in January was around my neck of the woods, we had loads of frost. I don't know about you.
Yeah, believe it or not, London, which I very rarely see a frost. I think I saw two very light ones last winter, had a proper five, six days of silver, really silver hard frost, which most importantly didn't thaw. It sat. You know, so you get it means it penetrates the top of the soil. It isn't just a ground frost, and that does a lot of good. It gets in, breaks the soil up, declods it if you've got heavy soil. So I was really glad to see it, and I just love those wintry, frosty days.
Oh, you know? No, don't we all? And when you have a day after a day after a day, and it just gets whiter and whiter and
yes,
whiter.
Yes, very, very beautiful. Yeah. And I just like the silhouette of the trees. And
yes.
It's, you know, people, obviously the cold isn't, some people feel it more than others, but I find it a very beautiful season.
I really loved particularly the blades of grass. You know, every individual blade of grass had an edge to it.
Yes.
Absolutely gorgeous. You've got to be a bit careful with grass though, haven't you?
Yeah, you'll blacken it if you go walking on it. It's probably not the best idea to go walking on frosted
so
grass.
So what blackens it then?
Well, just you kill the cells, you're crushing the cells. So the cells are obviously very like frozen. So they're obviously a lot more prone to damage. So I've seen many a time where you've had heavy frost in my younger years where people have walked across it and you literally get footprints in it where they've trodden it. Yeah. Yeah, so
okay.
It's not saying the grass wouldn't recover, it doesn't kill it,
yeah,
but it doesn't look too clever, you know.
No, I mean, I'm afraid I have to admit and say that I was still raking furiously just before those frosts came, actually. So, raking the leaves, but the leaves had fallen on the grass, and so what that meant was it was sort of doing two jobs at once because I was actually aerating a bit as I was going.
Yeah, scarifying with them, sort of dragging the rake over.
Yeah, then it froze and the grass was sort of laid over in these lovely kind of swirls where I'd raked. It was really, really lovely because the benefits of frost are perhaps that it might check some of those slugs and snails that we just talked about endlessly last year.
That's the big one because we had a terrible year last year for it. So hopefully that it will check the eggs, the overwintering eggs and stuff, you know, that they produce. There's a lot of benefits to the winter. Temperate plants, you know, roses and stuff like magnolias, they like a cold winter. It means you get, it stimulates them. You get a better growth off them come the growing season. And that's really important. For our soils, it's important. If you've got heavy soils, the frost gets in and breaks them up. Yeah. So it's doing a job for you there as well.
Yeah.
And like you say, things like aphids that might overwinter on honeysuckles or whatever, they'll all be checked as well. So I mean, it plays a pivotal role in our gardening season. So obviously we want to see more of it really. And that just means I think our growing season might be a bit easier if it's been exposed to cold weather.
It would be nice to think we still had a few more frosts ahead of us. We talk a lot about the fact that frosts are just not so common anymore. If you've got really heavy soil, if you've got clay, is it worth exposing certain areas of your veg patch, say, to a bit of frost? I know we like to keep the ground covered. I'm not suggesting, that you strip your whole veg patch bare. But, you know, would it help perhaps if you got one strip that was then more friable and easier to work with?
Yeah, well, traditionally as a gardener, if I had heavy clay soil, I would expose that to the cold. So we'd fork it over. I know people know dig now, I understand that. But you'd fork it over and you'd get the clods up and you'd expose that to the frost and the frost would break down those clods. So it does a really good job on heavy soils. So if you can, I mean, if you don't want to dig it over, just let the frost to the surface of a heavy clay will do a good job as well. So maybe if you know, this is a tricky part because we don't really know what the weather's going to do.
Yeah.
So if you know there's a really good cold snap coming, then expose your soil to it and let it break up. If you've got it covered, take the cover off and let the frost get into the soil because it does a very, very good job. But predicting when these things are going to happen has become harder and harder.
Yeah, and then having the time at that moment in order to prepare your soil for the frost that's on its way. Interestingly, slugs and snails aren't all hiding in the soil. I mean, they find all sorts of places, don't they? I mean, if we're trying to not replicate such a successful year for gastropods, what would you suggest in terms of trying to keep your garden a bit clearer of
them? Well, that's the thing. It really is important, I think, not to leave piles of stuff that you've just abandoned, so like pots and stuff together, because they'll just hibernate in there. It's a hygiene thing. Just try and keep things a bit tidier and not give them places to accumulate. You know, like I said, when I moved my allotment, they made this path and it was all full of old roof tiles and stuff. It was paradise for snails because they could all get under, keep warm and propagate, you know, reproduce. So, yeah, definitely one eye. I think it's an important part of gardening organically. Is I have to exercise a bit of hygiene and try and keep things a bit tidy.
Yeah.
I've got my bug hotels, I've got places and stuff like that.
Of course,
so yeah. But try and avoid places that you're going to encourage too much of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Of course, the other thing we always say about slugs and snails is if you're lucky enough to have a pond in your garden, then that encourages, you know, the frogs and toads to feast on the slugs and snails for you, ideally. So here we are in February. What should we be doing with our ponds?
Well, I'm just doing a bit of work on a job I've got, really, and that's it. I mean, it's looking very beautiful because it's all sort of story, but I'm going to do a little bit of cutting back. There's quite a lot of wildlife in this pond, so I want to get in there very sensitively, basically. I'll put my lasers on. I'm going to go in and I'm going to cut back stuff. I'm going to maybe divide a bit of stuff. There's typhus in there and a bit of flag iris and stuff. But I'm going to tread carefully because I don't want to disturb too much wildlife in there. There's newts in there. I don't want to give them a problem. There's a lot of oxygenator in there. It's become quite thick, so I'll take quite a bit of that out. I'll leave it on the side of the pond probably for half a day and let anything that's alive in it crawl back into the pond. And then that stuff's great if I chop it up and put it in a composting. A little bit tidying up operation, if you like.
That's interesting you say that, isn't it? Because I often forget about that and think, oh, the pond's just looking after itself. But then, of course, you don't want to touch it later because it's all coming to life.
Yes, yeah.
So try and get in there now on a day, obviously when it's not too frosty or too cold, and give those plants a bit of a cut back and then you're not disturbing the wildlife.
Yes, that's my plan. Just a tidy up operation, really. But I'm going to do it now where things are sleeping and dormant. And so when it kicks off, especially if I've got newts and frogs and stuff in there, when they start to come out and be active, I'd rather that all the work was done, basically.
Yeah, and I always want to leave my pond well alone and then watch things come to it. So I want the wildlife to think that it's an undisturbed place.
You want it. It's their place.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
I mean, the pond I'm working on, I want to make it more wildlife friendly. So we've got, you know, we've got ideas to put in hoverfly hotels and all this sort of stuff. All these little ideas we use. Because it's at the moment, it's like around the edge of it, it's all over Grammar Bramble. So I'll cut it back, then I'll start to work on the side and I'll introduce maybe a hedgehog house, or I'll try and then encourage more wildlife. So it just leaves a little bit of work this year because it's got overgrown. So I want to make it more productive when it comes to wildlife, basically.
Okay. There are other jobs that actually it's really good to be cracking on with in February. And one of them, I think, is probably pruning, isn't it? Of certain things, not everything, obviously, but I just What are those early pruners?
Yeah, this is quite a busy time for me, really, because things like orchards, apples, all doing this time of year, pears, all doing this time of year. So I'm spurring all of those. So when I say spurring, I look at the growth. And if you get these short, stumpy branches, if you like, about two or three sort of buds long, they're going to be my fruiting spurs, basically. But you'll also see on your fruit trees and your pear trees, these longer shoots, more whippy shoots. And that's what they're going to produce foliage. It's not going to produce. So I reduce them for next year's spurs. So it's quite a methodical, slow job. Put your long johns on, because it's not exactly a warm job either. But so I'll go through that. So that's quite an important time for fruit pruning. Things like climbing roses, even hybrid teas, I'll then start to spur prune all that back, and then I'll cut and stuff quite back quite hard. Shrubs like spireas and stuff that flowers on the first 6 months of the year, I'll cut those back as well. So it is quite a busy time.
You're never going to regret it, are you? Getting them, especially with roses, you know, the big regret is leaving it too late.
Well, they like vigour, so they respond to pruning. Yeah. That's why we hit them so hard, because same with a lot of shrubs, you know, a lot of deciduous shrubs. They like to be pruned back. If not, they get leggy, they get full of dead wood, the air doesn't pass through them quite as much. Probably in their native environment, they're probably chewed on by something that does that job for you, like deer. Yeah. So you kind of got to cut back and don't be shy, you know, to go in quite hard is my advice. Okay.
So, you've talked about a little bit about the orchard as well. At the allotment, what kind of pruning are you doing down there? Because I know the orchard's in a different place, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's somewhere else. Yeah, I'm not masses of pruning on the allotment. What I'll be thinking about at the end of this, because I've left all the tops on my herbaceous plants, my pollinator corridor, that's all still there because that helped protect the bulbs and the tumours and stuff as dahlias in there. I'll be looking at cutting that back at the end of the month.
Right.
So I'll leave that. That's quite a simple job, really. I've got some trees at the bottom of the allotment, which I like because they provide some cover from the buildings behind and a bit of a windbreak. But what tends to happen is they grow quite a lot. I think there's like a big hazel there, a hornbeam, I think. And I think with those, you have to raise the crown on them, basically, because they're full trees.
Yeah.
There's a bird cherry as well that's coming back to me now. And I tend to remove the lower branches so I can let the light into the allotment. So that's quite a nice job to do.
Pruning up from the bottom. Achievable, actually. Yeah. You haven't got to go faff around.
We do a little bit. I call it crown lifting, basically. Yes. So you're taking those lower branches off. A little tip for you as well is when you take a branch off, have a look at the base of the branch, because there'll be this ripple. I call it like a rhinoceros's neck, sort of ripple. That's your cambium ridge, okay? So prune to the outside of the cambium ridge, and then the plant automatically seals itself off against disease. It's called compartmentalisation. So when you're looking at a tree and you want to take a branch out, look at that wrinkle. You see it on cherries. They've got that really big wrinkle where the crotch, where the stem meets, the branch meets the stem. Cut to the outside of that wrinkle, and that means the tree will seal it off. Yeah.
Gosh, that's brilliant. What a fantastic tip. Gosh, it does help to talk to an expert, I have to say. I pick up all sorts whenever we have these chats. Whilst we're still at the allotment, I know you have a couch grass problem. We've talked about it many times. And I think you mentioned to me that you've had some mypex down for a long time. It's a bit controversial, mypex, isn't it?
But it can be, because it's got plastics in it.
However, you're trying to deal with a perennial problem of couch grass, and I think you said you've had some mypex down for 4 years. Do you think there will ever be a day when you lift that mypex off and the couch grass will be gone?
It was couch and horsetails, I've got double bubble, and they're both really, really hard weeds to eradicate once they're established. But I've had one piece down for about 4 years. I have another bit of land that's quite interesting, which I was working quite well, but gradually over the same period, the horsetail's re-establishing. Because you only need a little piece of it, all crouched, for it to come back. So I'm going to flip that piece of mypex over to the other part and then see what happens with this ground. That 4 years it's been covered. But I am suspicious. I think probably, especially a horsetail, will sit dormant decades, maybe. Yeah. I've been just curious, because I want to do this. Last time I didn't photograph it or anything, because it's quite a good thing to show people when you go and do talks. I do a talk on allotment. I do a lot of that. I do talks on allotments. I can then photographically record how these plants behave, you know, and I think that's maybe, for a good idea to record it, basically.
Very interesting. I went last year on a foraging course for my birthday, which was really good fun.
Yeah,
absolutely brilliant. I learned all sorts of things. But one of the discussions was about horsetail, mare's tail, and what I learned was that it tends to target places where there's sulfur deep down in
the soil. Right, yeah, because it goes down a long way.
So it may be that actually it doesn't matter what you try and do to eradicate it at the top level, there's probably no way you're going to, because actually it's reaching
it
down.
Goes down.
Something that's so far down that there's nothing you can do about it.
I think that's probably about right, because I think that I don't think you'll ever... I think it'll check it, and that's probably why it's worth doing. It won't be as... Because when the aerial did it before, it took a while for it to come back full swing.
Yeah.
So maybe if I postpone its aggression for a while, that sort of helps. And that's also, I hoe it off continually, so I disturb it continually. But I certainly think it's got those bootlace-type roots.
Yes.
I think you'll be lucky. I mean, I've said it before, I admire it, because it's an incredible plant.
It is an incredible plant.
But I have to fight it. I'm in a war with it. If I want to grow food, I've got to battle it.
And I presume if you do yank some up, you're not going to be sticking it on the compost heap. But what are you going to be doing with your compost in February?
Well, I'll give my compost a turn. I'll do it very delicately. I'll do it with my arms, because the slow worms will probably be in there. They're usually in there. And if I see them, that brings me great delight. But yeah, I'll just give it a turn. If it's very dry, which it has been a little bit in London the last few weeks, I'll maybe get some moisture into it, and I'll be thinking about how I want to use it as well, because it's always that time. I love it when you start to turn it and you see it's ready for action. It's
something you can use.
I've got quite a lot this year as well. I've filled nearly two bays, so there's quite a lot of stuff there.
Of course, you're using your compost, but what about leaf mould? I mean, it's a good time of year to mix up some sowing compost, isn't it?
If I've got some ready, I've got like a sort of chicken wire bay of leaves full. I've been turning them occasionally, and I've also kept moisture on them. So if I've got some stuff down the bottom of that that's ready, then I'll get myself a bag of silver sand and I'll do some seed sowing.
Absolutely. Well, look, what are the main jobs, really, that you want to make sure you've done by the end of this month?
Certainly, I'll be digging. I love this job. I know most people wouldn't, but I love digging out my propagators, and I love getting in the kitchen with them and giving them all a good wash.
Yes,
and I love that sort of that preparation,
sort
you know,
renewal.
Sort of training before a football match sort of feeling, you know. It's really that. So I love that job. I'll also, I mean, I've got a big sort of container full of pots and stuff down the allotment. They'll all get washed. That'll be a cold job, so I'll have to use a bucket and some and it won't be, there's no heated water. But I'll go through everything methodically. My shed, I always talk about that every year. That'll get a really good clean. Probably give that a lick of paint, actually. And then it's just about looking at the seed catalogs and thinking about what I'm going to do. It's that I've not made any massive plans yet. I want that to come. I'm looking forward to that this month.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it is that time of year where you start to think there's anything.
As the days get longer, the days start to draw out, you just get, and you might then suddenly get
optimism.
Yeah, then you might get one day where it's clear sky and you feel a little tiny bit of sun on your face and you think, okay.
Absolutely. So you're going to get your containers washed. You might have mixed up a little bit of seed compost. If you haven't mixed up seed compost,
certainly I'll get, when I get all my propagators washed out and stuff, I'll order myself a bag of Silver Grow seed compost. 50 litre, that'll do me more than I need for the season. I have very great success with that. That'll be part of the preparations. I'll start getting my potatoes in and start chitting them as well. That'll happen. So there's quite a lot. Suddenly you find yourself, you do all your pruning in February, get that done, and you get towards the end of the month, you think, well, it's like this new phase coming in, basically. You start to get excited about that.
I had great success with my potatoes last year, so I'm looking forward to that this year and getting those lined up and getting my seed potatoes ready. And in fact, you know, around the country, various people do potato days, don't they? And you can find local groups.
Only in the UK would you have a potato.
It's marvellous. It's absolutely brilliant. But in terms of the seeds that you actually sow this month, you know, I know you're you like me are a bit of a slow start. I don't want to get this all going too early. It's just too much to keep alive, frankly, for too long. But what are you going to be sowing this month?
Well, my first wave, I mean, you can sow a bit earlier. If you've got a heated glass house or maybe some lights and stuff, then you can start now if you want. But I'm just not that much of a rush. I want the season to change. But this end of this month will be chilies, tomatoes, peppers, aubergine, those sort of Mediterranean hot crops. They like a long season to be productive. So they'll all go in the propagators at the end of this month, basically. And I'll be looking at my heritage seed library list, of course.
Good.
I'll be getting online. I'll be having a little chat with Katrina. I'm always like tapping her shoulder for a few seed. And I'll get online and have a look at the catalogue. And then that's part of the process of what the second wave will be as well, what I start to sow later in the year.
Yeah, so that's our Heritage Seed Library here, and Katrina is our head of the Heritage Seed Library. And for anyone listening who's never perhaps heard of the Heritage Seed Library before, each year there's a seed catalogue and it contains well over 100 seeds. These are heritage varieties. You can't get them in the shops. These are varieties that have been handed down through the generations, and we here, Garden Organic at Wrighton, we conserve them, and then we can then bulk up enough of them to make sure that if you're a member of the Heritage Seed Library, you can order 6 packets of seed each year and we send them out to you. And Chris, you'll be pleased to know I have some inside knowledge. There's a couple of tomato varieties that are still available. The seed list is open till the end of February, so you've got to get your skates on. But Crystal's Plum and Fox Cherry are two varieties.
I've grown Fox Cherry before. It's very delicious. Yeah.
Delicious.
I have to say, the heritage varieties in taste, I
mean, tastes brilliant.
Just for that alone, is this worth becoming a member? Because it just steps up to another level when you eat these for taste. They're just incredible.
Yeah, absolutely, no doubt about it. Are you sowing any flowers at this time, or is it still too early?
I mean, we'll be thinking about it. I like my summer bedding. I like my colour for the balcony. I grow all of it from seed, so I'm not buying it, you know, in modules and whatever.
You're doing it properly.
Yeah, I'd grow it from seed. So lobelias, probably one, or maybe a petunia at the end of this month. Yeah. I like those nice early sowings. This year, I want to concentrate on growing stuff maybe that's a bit more tolerant of dry periods. So I'm looking at pelargoniums, South African sort of bedding plants by origin, stuff that I don't have to worry. It's just going to flag if I'm not there 3 days.
Yes.
So environmentally, I think there'll be less expense on that as well. So I'm going to play around a bit this year, I think, and have a look at some different stuff. You've got things like gazinias and, you know, that. They're starting to come on the market as bedding plants.
Yes, that's true.
You can buy the seed, which are much more tolerant of conditions and are not so fussy.
Yeah. It does amaze me, you know, how quick they are, you know, from seed. It really
They're up, they want to go up, they want to flower straight away.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I love, certainly in a balcony area, I like to see that colour. I really do.
I love the idea of, you know, going for drier bedding. Because again, as you say, one of the things that's so depressing is, you go away for a couple of days and it all just shrivels up. But actually,
They do take the sort of, the softer plants need a lot of water, certainly when they're establishing, that's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's plenty to be doing. February, it really is beginning to kick us all into action, isn't it? Definitely. I'm really looking forward to comparing notes with you next month.
We're having a bean competition, aren't we? Is that...
Well, we are, but that's not for another couple.
I know. Yeah, that's further down the line.
That's right. Yes, so I bought Chris for Christmas a variety of bean, and we'll be talking about that in the next couple of episodes, because I want to sow alongside Chris and I want to compare notes, these beans.
We're
having a bean off. Absolutely. So there'll be more on that.
Yeah, there will.
Great fun. Fantastic. Right. See you next time.
Cheers, Fiona.
Last year, Anton and I were delighted to be joined by geologist and keen grower, Eddie Bailey. Eddie runs workshops around the UK, educating people on the activity in their soil through his company Rhizophilia. He's even visited us here and gave a workshop to our staff a year or two ago. Eddie believes that by stopping digging and following organic principles, you can increase the microbial activity in your soil. We asked him first to introduce himself.
Thank you, Fiona. So I'm a chartered geologist. So I've spent my 35 years career drilling thousands of boreholes on hundreds and hundreds of farms across the UK and overseas, looking at the mineral structure of soils, talking to farmers.
You're also a keen grower, aren't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. The family were keen growers. When I was 5 years old, I was commissioned as the digging expert on my father's allotment and spent many a winter turning over the soil, keeping warm, following his lead. I think my earliest time was 1969, 1970 was when I started. And I've actually been allotmenting ever since. I even allotmented in my halls of residence and house at university.
Wow. So you always grow some of your own
food. As much as I possibly can.
Over all those years that you've been growing, have you noticed a difference in terms of yield? What are you noticing?
I was digging and rotivating for 20 years and I just noticed the soil crusting over and germination rates dropping. And I just thought, what on earth is going on? Mm. So I started to investigate around about 2010. We had Google then.
Yeah.
And so when I found biological crusts, I thought, biology. And I started working with biology. I stopped digging, stopped rotivating, started working with the biology. And the difference was extraordinary.
You're a huge proponent then of no dig.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, when did you first really get interested in no dig? Why shouldn't we be digging? What are the sort of advantages of it?
So about 2010, I started noticing this compaction in my crusting in the soils, looked at the biological aspect and stopped digging. I see it as soil food web gardening and growing more than organic, if you like, and no dig because the soil food web from the studies I've done on evolutionary biology is just underpins it all. Mm. So and what are the two most important things? Well, don't dig, don't turn the house upside down, and be organic. Don't shove chemicals on it. Those are absolutely two fundamental parts. You can go organic like I did, absolutely no chemicals whatsoever for 20 years, but I was digging. So I only had one part of the equation right. When I stopped digging, I made big improvements, but as I followed through with what the biology was doing, and I started understanding that and playing with the biology and doing experiments, well, I then noticed another uptick in the productivity of my gardens.
While you were busy, you know, growing at home, the day job was all about going and digging boreholes and digging in fields. And I'd love to know what you were noticing in your work as well.
So farmers were complaining of a lack of manganese or some other nutrient, zinc or what have you, and having to supplement. And I was taking samples to a laboratory and finding all the manganese that you could possibly want. So the question to me was, well, if it's in the soil, why isn't it getting into the plants?
I think this is a big problem. Often it is a question of availability rather than whether it's there or not. So if you've got your sort of soil conditions right, because often these sort of micronutrients, plants only actually need very small amounts of them. So it's not a question of quantity, it's a question of whether the plants can actually get at them or not. So it's having your soil conditions right and having the biology right is so much more important than sort of taking that absolute soil test values.
Completely agree. Absolutely. And it is the biology. There isn't a soil on this planet that hasn't got the nutrients available. What is stopping them getting into the plants? It's the biological bridge, you know, the mycorrhizal fungi and the mycorrhizal fungi working with your full suite of bacteriums. And that's what they evolved to do. And that's bridges broken in so many agricultural and garden scenarios.
Could you say a little bit more about what a mycorrhizal fungi is? Because not all our listeners might know, they might have heard the term, but what exactly is a mycorrhiza?
So the mycorrhizal fungi, it's the most ancient lineage. They evolved 1.5 billion years ago, and their job is to procure nutrients. They are the miners of the soil. So their little hyphae go out into the soil and gather with their bacterial helpers the titanium and the selenium and the zinc, all these micronutrients that, as Anton says, you need in tiny amounts, but absolutely essential amounts for metabolic pathways to work, you know, photosynthesis. And now the plant has got access to the entirety of the soil mineral nutrients around. But unfortunately, that's not what's happening in agricultural fields because ploughing and chemical fertilizers or synthetics destroy the mycorrhizal fungi.
We did actually do some work on this quite a long time ago. I think it's about 20 years ago. And we did look at sort of comparable organic farms and conventional farms. And we did find that there were lower levels of mycorrhizae in the conventional farm. So why would that be?
They become oxidized by ploughing. And so there's this huge biomass which has been lost over probably a couple of centuries. And it's up there in the atmosphere.
I'd also heard that basically if you feed the plants with a lot of fertilizer, they no longer support the mycorrhizal growth. It's like I don't know, giving them a ready-made pizza. They don't do the work anymore. Is there any sort of work?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, there's a cracking book. It's a bit of a chunky read, Marshner's Mineral Nutrition of Higher Plants. And there's research going back, you know, two or three decades that demonstrates that if you feed a plant artificially, that you switch off the gene that sends those exudates, the carbon sugars that the microbes feed on, it switches off, of course, in those exudates, you've also got the signaling molecules, various amino acids that are designed to feed the microorganisms in the soil. So you artificially fertilize, that plant then becomes absolutely dependent on further fertilization, and you end up in this vicious cycle.
We must talk about compost, because that's obviously in our DNA.
Absolutely.
Here. We spend a lot of time talking about it, and we teach people how to compost effectively, and we know the difference it makes. But what interests me about composting is that it's a human activity, but actually what you're talking about is a biological activity that's going on under the soil. So if we're overlaying a human activity to kickstart a biological activity with two separate piles of soil, if you like, you've got your compost being put on top of soil, is there a danger that we are not making the right connections, that we're relying on nature to actually then make those connections? I'm curious about that, because in a way we're interfering.
So compost is about 40% of the answer in terms of the nutrients that the microbes that have evolved to grow plants, in my view, from an evolutionary biology point of view, something I did at university, and I'm passionate about as a geologist. Plants are absolutely fundamental to the health of the soil. They are putting out these carbon sugars, and 60% of what the research is showing, 60% of the nutrition that the soil needs to keep that workforce healthy is through plant exudates. 40% is the composts that you put down. If it's a healthy compost, they're also imbibed with fungi, mycorrhizal, saprotrophic fungi, breaking down carbon, protozoans, nematodes, and they're all part of this soil food system, which is supporting the plant. So you're adding community.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that is so important. So if you have bare soil in between, say, a row of carrots, well, that soil isn't being fed. So the microorganisms, they won't be there and they'll be depleted. So I'm an absolute advocate of having every square inch covered with some vegetation or other. And if it's not your crop, well, let your chickweed grow in between. It's serving a very vital purpose, putting carbon sugars into the ground.
So you would say to the sort of allotment holders that perhaps they shouldn't be weeding their plots over the winter, because that's always an issue. I mean, we're a big advocate of green manures and having the crop covered with those, but sometimes gardeners don't manage to get a green manure in. So would they be better off leaving the weeds to grow?
Big advocate of green manures. Yeah, absolutely. And for that same reason, it's actually quite convenient, you know, if you haven't got too much time, just at the end of a cropping, like just throw some mustard down or some phacelia or something down. Yeah, no, big advocate. Whatever you grow, and then in between my phacelia, by the way, at the moment, are growing chickweeds. Beautiful. I harvest those for pecoras, lots of calcium in them. So they're a crop, you know, but they're doing a job. If you see a weed popping up in any part of your garden, that's nature telling you, okay, you haven't done what you should be doing. I'll take over. A seed will germinate and it'll start putting sugars and amino acids into the ground to feed the microbial population.
We're recording this interview on a really frosty morning, and we often give the advice at this time of year that it's important to have your soil covered, absolutely, but perhaps don't waste high-value compost that you've created in your own compost heap on your garden at this time of the year and save that up for when it gets a bit warmer again. What's your view on the work that goes on under the soil in the winter?
So it continues. It's slower, obviously, because of temperature, but it's still going on. Yeah. And these microorganisms, they don't hibernate as such. Some, under really stressful conditions like drought, will go into little cysts and they'll effectively hibernate. But throughout the winter, that soil's probably you know, a couple of inches down. It's probably still 4 or 5 degrees. There's respiration going on. There's reproduction going on. So they do need to sort of come into winter with a belly full, as I like to see it, you know. So I try and feed them up,
yeah,
you know, throughout September and October, so that they've got sufficient carbon in a form which they can easily use. So I'll use kind of soluble carbon feeds made out of my compost. But yeah, I don't put down huge layers of mulch on the winter. It's unnecessary.
Yeah.
I say that it won't rot down. It'll rot up into the atmosphere.
So from a practical point of view, if I'm just a gardener, what should I be doing over the winter to sort of make sure I support that life in my soil and it's ready there in the spring, ready to go next season?
I think the cover crops are absolutely vital. I think that they are so important. You know, the roots are in that zone that is still functioning, still feeding. I do spread thin. It's almost like casting lawn seed. You know, I'll get my bags of compost and just scatter it, just to fill in the gaps. You know, that will work. Some of it will work its way down. It's much more efficient. I don't have to put these big, thick layers down. But yeah, I'll just cast, you know, every few weeks, just a little spray of my compost.
So if you're looking at your soil at home, as I do from time to time, how can I be sure that all this activity is going on? I mean, sure, I can wait for a good crop perhaps, or a good harvest, but actually you want to be checking in. We talk a lot about observing all the year round. What are the indicators that tell me that actually my soil's doing okay?
Water, this time of year. If water's pooling on the surface or isn't draining particularly well, then it might be compacted. If you've got algae on the surface, moss growing on the surface, that might be an indicator that the drainage isn't quite as good as it could be, and microbes don't breathe and function quite as well. All the ones we want to help grow our plants don't function quite as well in soggy, wet soils.
I read it in a book somewhere that the mycorrhizae were responsible for allowing plants to gather enough nutrients and to grow to the extent that they could actually pull enough CO2 out of the atmosphere and basically create the atmosphere that we've now got for other creatures to live. If it wasn't for mycorrhizae, none of us would be here at all today. We wouldn't have this atmosphere.
Yeah, there was only so much nutrients that the algae that could survive desiccation could pull from the water, from the ponds that they were in. You know, that just had to come through simple diffusion and absorption. But when you've got mycorrhizae, which can actually get into the cell itself, a direct route into where the machinery of the plant is, then it can just shuttle it in and the plant has got the nutrients to grow big. They didn't get it quite right to begin with. The mass of liverworts and mosses that first evolved took so much carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere that we ended up with this global glaciation and a mass extinction, one of the second or third biggest in the geological record. And a couple more times throughout the early geological history of plants, that happened. Until about 300 million years ago, there was obviously a conversation signaling, kicking off between the algae and the fungi, saying, we can't keep having this boom and bust. What's going wrong? We need to cycle some of this carbon back into the atmosphere. And if we can cycle it, that actually we've got homeostasis. And we've then enhanced the carbon cycle. So how do we go about doing that? And the fungi came up with the solution and said, well, if we just change some of the organic acids that we've produced, then the lignin which we have developed, or evolution has developed, that allows plants to go skyrocketing up 100 meters or more in certain tree species, well, we can degrade the lignin. So when the plant dies, falls over and rots, instead of it just becoming buried, well, we'll create a form that'll later be known as saprotrophic fungi, the mushroom type, and we decompose what falls, and then we cycle. Now, at that point in time, the amount of carbon that we had in the atmosphere was, give or take, about 300 parts per million. And it's been that way except for a few tectonic events and asteroids and huge volcanic eruptions, it's been pretty much like that for the last 300 million years. When saprotrophic fungi were invented, we had the carbon cycle that we see today, give or take. And everything we see around us, ourselves included, have evolved to that particular niche. I hear talk of the carbon dioxide levels rising as being a good thing because plants love carbon dioxide. Yeah, to a point. We all like Mars bars, but if you had like 30 Mars bars, you'd feel pretty sick. We've evolved to this 300 parts per million, give or take. And if we get too far out of kilter with that, then our species will change.
And our role in this fundamentally comes down to looking after our soils as gardeners.
Yeah, there's no better way of bringing carbon back into the soil than through those microbial workers. That's what they're designed to do. I saw a program, Panorama, a few weeks ago on carbon sequestration. An hour-long program, they talked about basalt rock dust. You know, that's sort of big in the news at the moment as a way of sequestering carbon. They talked of biochar, you know, other ways of putting carbon into the soil in a form that just will not get degraded. And in that hour-long program, there was not a single mention of the soil. And I just thought that's just so, so missing the point.
So apparently I'd heard that in the UK, the amount of carbon that we've got stored in our soil accounts for about 80 years worth of our sort of CO2 emissions. So yeah, we've got a lot stored there. But yeah, we can't carry on behaving the way we can, I think, is part of the message we've got.
Yeah, absolutely. There's more carbon in the atmosphere from the depletion of the organic matter, the bodies of these microorganisms that was in the soil 200, 300 years ago, than there is from fossil fuels. I mean, that's a big kick, of course. But the amount of microbial biomass, these workers, the workforce that has been lost to the atmosphere is enormous. Yeah, that to me, we need to be looking at our soils and sequestering carbon. It's there, ready to suck up the carbon out of the atmosphere all over the planet. And it can be started tomorrow. You know, in my garden, the effect I had when I stopped digging was instantaneous. You know, the following season, germination rates just dramatically improved, you know, and got better and better within 3 years. It was a completely different landscape. I've obviously evolved it since, how I grow and how I intercrop and how I allow weeds to grow in amongst things like cosmos and other pretty flowers, just because that's diversity. Yeah, no, absolutely. The soil is absolutely critical to our health on this planet.
So time now for the postbag, and I'm here with Chris Collins and Dr. Anton Rosenfeld. Hello, both of you.
Hi, Fiona.
Hiya.
So we've got our first question here from Peter. I'm considering installing raised beds to grow organic veg, and I want some advice about sourcing topsoil for these. The contractor is suggesting British Sugar topsoil, but would that qualify as organic? And if not, can you recommend a sustainable source of topsoil? Gosh, lots in this question. First of all, Anton, what is British Sugar topsoil?
So British Sugar is the major company that produces sugar in this country, and that all comes from sugar beet. And when they process the sugar beet, they're like great big sort of mangles, basically. There's a lot of soil that adheres to the sugar beets as they're dug up, and that gets brushed off, but they're left with a great big pile of soil after they processed it. And so basically that would just get thrown out, so they sell as topsoil.
Okay, but there's no suggestion that it's organic.
No, there certainly isn't. I mean, majority of that won't be from organic certified land.
Isn't there a concern with neonicotinoids with sugar beet?
So, yeah, there well might be, because although neonicotinoids have been banned in this country, they are still granted derogations to use them in exceptional circumstances, but basically the farms growing sugar beet have managed to get these derogations every year since the ban. So one of the things about neonicotinoids is that even if it's a really small amount, it can have a really big impact on insect populations. So that would possibly be a worry, I think.
So lots of reasons not to use it, I think. How then do you get hold of organic topsoil?
So officially, there's no such thing as organic topsoil. A certified organic system is meant to be grown in the soil that's there, so importing soil isn't an option. But for those people that are perhaps gardeners and want to grow sustainably, you want to look for soil that has a standard that's known as BS3882, and that they have actually checked that for sort of contaminants and pesticides. There might even be still sort of tiny residues in there, but they've got some sort of quality assurance on the quality of this soil.
So, Chris, living in a city, as you do, if you need to get hold of some topsoil, how can you make sure that you can get topsoil that is to the right standard, you know, your BS3882?
Well, what Anton says is right. It's quite difficult to know if it's going to be purely organic. That's quite a hard one. In an ideal world, we'd obviously be making compost and we'd be adding it to our gardens and we'd be planting in situ. But our friends who've written in have raised beds, they need to fill it. Obviously, sometimes when I'm doing landscape jobs, I need to import topsoil. So there is what I try to do is, there's no guarantee, so I try to make it as local as possible. So there's a place only a couple of miles up the road from me that does it on quite a big scale. And I think most of that topsoil tends to come from where there's building contracts going on and the topsoil's being excavated before footings go in for houses and stuff. So you're hoping it's going to be quite good quality if it's coming from there. So I tend to buy it from there. That reduces petrol miles. It's me keeping it local. So you're trying to do the least environmental impact, really. And that's pretty much how I go about it. I have to say, Fiona, it's the biggest pile of topsoil I've ever seen. I get tempted to do roly-polies down it when I see it. It really is quite a sight. But I think I'm close as I can be to being environmental with that topsoil. So you just do a little bit of research, I think.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I've bought it in myself from the likes of Fielding Merchants. Gets delivered in great big yellow bags. It does have the standard. So it is possible to get it and to get it delivered.
Yeah, this stuff comes in tongue bags, basically. And it's got the BS on it. Yeah.
Brilliant. Right, moving on. Ruth has written to us. She says, do you have any suggestions of plants that like wet ground? I'm trying blueberries and cranberries this year, but I'd like to add more variety. Okay, so Chris, if that was you and you've got a patch of wet ground, what's the first thing you would think of planting there?
Oh, it's a big, big list, really. I would love, I've kind of this sort of damp grounds or sort of alongside of streams or round ponds is my favourite kind of planting, to be honest with you. So I'm presuming it's not waterlogged because that obviously creates different conditions or different options. So I definitely put probably some hazel in and some hornbeam. They'd be, and I'd chop them down after a year or a couple of years and let them coppice, because you can read all sorts of bushcraft with that wood. They also look very beautiful when they're coppiced and they tassel up and stuff. So,
and they're quick as well, aren't they?
Very quick. Well, they're pioneer plants, so they take out new ground. So I kind of like, I'd probably put those in. This is an ornamental garden really for me. Then I'd probably, there's lots of interesting stuff, lots of colour and change, like stilbes are great in moist ground, penistamen, rodgersia. Is one of my favourite plants. There's big sort of like almost chestnut-like leaves and white plumes of flowers, very beautiful. Flowers are echinacea, will grow in wet ground. Heleniums will grow in wet ground. There's a big list you can go out there and do. So I'd probably backdrop it with some coppicing and have a little bit of colour and ornamental going on in front of it.
Lovely. Sounds gorgeous. If Ruth is thinking just along the lines of food growing, perhaps, what would be your steer there, Anton?
I would go for some of the sort of more berries and things like that, would just judging by what she's already trying to grow. I mean blueberries, they're really sort of bog plants, so I'm presuming she's got slightly acidic soil perhaps. I found that sort of black currants are reasonably tolerant of damper soils, so that would be something I would go for. I find things like the gooseberries and red currants need a little bit better drainage. She wants to grow veg, then I would go for more of the sort of leafy crops and things which are shallower rooting, things like chards and salad crops and things like that. She's in a warmer spot. I'm not sure where she is in the country. You might want to try something like taro, colocasia. because that's something that looks nice and you might even get a few tubers off it. You can also use the leaves to make patra, which is a really nice Indian snack. If you're going to have a go at growing taro, you really need a pretty sheltered spot, and you might need to actually bring them in over the winter as well.
Okay. Right. Well, I might have a go at that myself. I've never even thought of growing taro, and I've got all sorts of damp spots in my garden.
So you can actually get the tubers from Indian supermarket or Caribbean supermarket, and they will actually grow. So it's worth having a go.
Definitely. Really good. Okay. Lots of fantastic, unusual ideas there. Now, Kathy has written in with a question that a lot of people wrote in with last year. So let's unpack this one. Last year, we found we had rats in our compost heap. So we avoided growing roots in the bed where we use the compost. And instead, we grew summer squash and tomatoes. Would you say that after all the microbial activity in the soil over the autumn and winter of last year, we should be now okay to grow onions and carrots in that same bed this year? Okay, so very, very timely question, and I think probably a pertinent question. Anton, what would you do in this situation?
Okay, so the thing that people worry about with rats is leptospirosis, sometimes known as Weil's disease. It can be a problem in rivers and things like that. People who swim have got open cuts and things might be more risk. The risk in your compost is going to be pretty small, partly because by the time you've taken the compost and then spread it on the soil, the amounts are actually really very, very, very small. And I mean, if you're going to be on the safe side, I would say if you're planting into something and it was fresh compost, I would avoid root crops that were going to be eaten raw, something like raw carrots and things like that. But they've already left it a whole growing season. I think the risk is really very, very small. I'd go as far as say yes and be fine.
I guess one other question about rats is, if they've found a nice hospitable compost bin and they've bred successfully, you know, is there danger that they come back to the same spot? Do we know that about rats?
So rats, as far as I know, they don't tend to always come back to the same spot, but they like to just go to somewhere which is conducive for rats to bring up their young. So, I mean, a compost bin is ideal. It's got a source of food and a nice source of warmth. So you're providing that for them. Then if they've come once, then
they'll be back.
Yeah.
I mean, that's right. I mean, they're opportunists, aren't they?
They are. They'll take advantage. And I think that basic compost rule as well is just avoid meats and dairy products and fish. Don't put those on your compost heap because that's definitely going to attract them. So keep that compost turned as well, will reduce the chances. So yeah, hopefully you won't end up with a problem.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Good luck, Kathy. Right. Well, thanks ever so much for all your wisdom. As usual, Chris and Anton, see you next time. That's all we've got time for this month. Thanks so much to Eddie Bailey for joining us. As we're starting a new year, now is the perfect time to become a member of Garden Organic. Our resources will enable you to create a wildlife-friendly, productive garden whilst supporting our vital campaigning work. Become a member by visiting gardenorganic.org.uk/join. If you enjoy the Organic Gardening Podcast, do subscribe or follow us via your podcast provider, and also share it with someone you know. All that's left for me to do now is to thank Kevin MacLeod for the music. That's it. Until next time.